Hello and welcome to Happy Place, the podcast where I, Fern Cotton, meet people who have lived extraordinary lives and dealt with some pretty heavy situations. This week is no exception as we meet journalist and writer Paula Bell.
Knowing what I now know about depression, especially that kind of depression that begins in childhood, there were so many questions I should have asked him about it, and I didn't.
A word of warning, as we occasionally do on this series, there's a discussion of suicide, and in this case, what happened to the people caught in its aftermath. If that's something that's not going to help you at this time, feel free to pause the show and come back to it when you're in a better place. Okay, you're still with me. Paula is a wonderful, inspiring woman, and I can't wait to introduce you to her.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And now, here's the show. So, Paula, I'm so happy and thrilled that you're in my house right now.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that I get to look in your gorgeous eyes for an hour. By the way, like, you can't see what's going on right now, but Paula has the most extraordinary eyes ever in
Thanks.
The world.
I made them myself.
I know. When I first met you, I was like, blatantly contacts. And you're like, actually, no, they're not.
I'm really glad that you didn't share that with me at the time.
Well, I was mesmerised. I want to talk about when I first met you, which was probably... It was maybe about a year and a half ago, I'm estimating.
I would say it
longer?
Was
two?
Just before Calm came out.
Okay, so about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
And all I knew about you at this point, well, I didn't know very much at all, like you do when you go into new situations. I knew that you were big at Huffington Post. You're an editor, you're extremely smart. I'm instantly coming into that feeling quite intimidated and, oh my God, and she's got amazing eyes. Oh my God, everything's brilliant about this woman. She's perfect. You're interviewing me about depression, anxiety and stuff. And it was thoroughly nerve-wracking. And then I walked away thinking that was very nice and Paula was lovely and not as scary as I imagined. And then, a little after that, I got your beautiful book that I can't stop telling everyone about, Chasing the Rainbow, and read your story. And it obviously took me aback hugely. And it was one of those moments where you go, God, you assume so much about someone from meeting them once. And you see someone who's got a brilliant job, and who looks gorgeous and is very competent at their job. And you don't even think about what their life's been like or what they might have been through. But for those people that haven't read your book or don't know much about it, can you... It's hard to summarise, but could you tell us roughly what story you're telling in that book?
Yeah, so Chase the Rainbow is a memoir, but it's also, there's a little bit of journalism in there because I'm a journalist. And it's about my life with my husband, Rob. And when I tell people that I've written a memoir, you know, and they don't know who I am or what the story is, they laugh and they're like, oh, ho, 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 you're so young. You know, how could you have written a memoir? And then I tell them and then their face just kind of drops. But it's basically my husband passed away 3 years ago from suicide. And he struggled with chronic depression. So he'd had this depression since he was a kid. And about 2.5 years into our marriage, and you know, up until that point, he hadn't really been that depressed. So I didn't really know what it was like to be with someone, you know, who had full-on depression. But about 2.5 years into being married, I just thought, you know, something's just not right here. And he then revealed to me that in addition to having depression, he also had a full-blown addiction to heroin, which he had tried to keep a secret from me because he tried to get clean before I found out what was going on because he was so sure that, you know, if I knew the truth, I would leave him, which I didn't at that point, and helped him with recovery. So at that point, I had no clue about what depression was. I mean, as far as I knew, no one in my family had it. I mean, of course, looking back on it now, someone in my family must have had depression, but, you know, we didn't really talk about it. And the only reference point I had was a female friend of mine who went through surgery, you know, minor surgery, but what ended up happening was she got depressed and eventually went on medication and then was fine. Like, it didn't recur after that. And I was just like, okay, well, she had it, but, you know, she got over it. That's the phrase that I would use, which I would never use now about depression. But, you know, she got over it. So he's telling me that he has depression, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be anything major. So it's fine. And also it was his mannerism of how he spoke about it. You know, he wasn't flippant, but he was very confident about it. So I thought, okay, he obviously is telling me about this thing that he's been dealing with, but he seems to have it perfectly in hand. So, you know, there's nothing really for me to worry about. And knowing what I now know about depression, especially that kind of depression that begins in childhood, there were so many questions I should have asked him about it, and I didn't.
Well, you know, this, I guess, is something that luckily is being talked about so much more because of brilliant books like yours. And I guess especially men hearing more about the fact that talking is a great thing to do. Do you think that Rob did struggle to express himself to other people around him and reach out for help perhaps as well?
Hugely, because he didn't really see a psychiatrist, like a proper psychiatrist who could tailor medication for him, until he was about 36, and he died when he was 39. There was a lot going on there. So, you know, when he was a lot younger, the treatments that you have for depression were a lot cruder, less was known about it. But for sure, he definitely struggled with the idea of normality. So for him, you know, having depression meant that he wasn't normal, and he desperately, desperately wanted to be normal. So he expended huge amounts of energy trying to maintain this facade of normality. So, for example, when we got married, you know, what should have happened was we should have gotten married with the full understanding of what depression was like for him, and to know that when he was depressed, this is what we would do as a couple, etc., etc. But half of the time, he was so invested in, you know, not making me feel like depression affected our relationship or would affect me, that it came at great personal cost to him. So I don't think that really worked for him.
And of course, you know, for anyone experiencing depression, the circle around your people you love are affected, whatever. You know, even if you do have a plan, you know, it's still going to be detrimental in ways, or there's still going to be challenges you have to overcome. When Rob was having a tough time and he was in a dark place, how did you cope with that personally? Because it is so much for you to take, you know, it's a huge responsibility for you because you love that person and you don't want to see them like it. You feel, I'm imagining, very hopeless in that situation. But you've also got to carry on in your life, and you have friends, job, passions, love. You know, how did you cope with that?
So I'm a avid diary keeper. So, you know, there's a lot that I didn't realize until I revisited those diaries and read how I felt during that time. Because when you are dealing with someone who's really depressed, as I was with Rob, you know, there's a huge amount of physical energy, for example, that's expended, because you're the one doing the supermarket shop. You're the one making sure that things are afloat. So you're basically doing the jobs of two people, even, you know, stuff like cleaning the house. And from an emotional point of view, you know, your emotions kind of get shunted to the back, but that doesn't mean that they're not there. And so for me, I remember the physical stuff. So I remember having to go to the shop, but the emotional stuff, I didn't realize until I read this entry where I just said, you know, I know that when you are married to someone, you are supposed to support them in sickness and in health. And absolutely, that's what I'm going to do with Rob. But it is really hard and it's really getting me down, and nothing I do seems to make a difference. And that speaks to such a naivety, because of course it's an illness. You know, what I can do, or what I did as a partner, was to support him, not to make him feel crappy about not being able to, you know, get out of bed or do this and that. But it still affected me, you know, hugely as a person. And also, there was an idea of what I felt couples should do together. So, you know, something as simple as go out on a Saturday afternoon and get coffee, you know. And for a lot of the time when Rob especially was ill, you know, he just wouldn't be out of bed. Like, he wouldn't be able to get up. So we didn't necessarily do stuff like that for a big chunk of our relationship when he was ill. And I have to say, for me, it was enormous at the time, but I was just trying to sort of pedal, you know, put one foot in front of the other and get through it. So I don't think there was a day when I just felt completely overwhelmed by it. I think there was just a low level feeling of, this is really hard, and I have to hope that one day, you know, it's going to lift. And when I realized that it wasn't really lifting, and this wasn't something that was just going to go away overnight, I started to reclaim certain bits of my life. So, for example, I used to stay at home a lot with Rob because I just felt quite guilty going out. And I was like, you know, if he's feeling terrible, I don't really want to go out. But I was just like, you know, I need to go out because I need to reconnect with my friends. I need to do the things that I love doing because that's what's going to nurture me. And also Rob, you know, hugely was supportive of that. He just said, look, I feel like I'm ruining your life, and I really want you to be able to just go out and get back out there and have a good time. But it was always hard maintaining that balance of, you know, going out and knowing in the back of my head that he was at home on his own.
Well, of course, because that's also massively alienating for you, because as you said, everyone by default compares their situation to others. You know, it's our way of working out how we fit into society and where and how we fit into our friendship circles. And I think a lot of us do that. We go, oh, well, that couple always do this, or that family do this. And that can be very alienating, because if you don't know anyone else experiencing what you're going through, can you say anything? Did you talk to friends about it? Can you admit those feelings? Is there then guilt on top of that, that you're telling other people Rob's situation? You know, how did you communicate that to others?
Well, for a big part of our lives was that we didn't. Ooh. So it's really, you know, it's really interesting when you look at it now. And when I consider how much of my life is in that book and how much was out there, I mean, this is stuff I could never have spoken about when he was alive, because I just felt it was so taboo. It was so personal. Ooh. There were so many emotions that I was struggling with in terms of, I'm in this relationship with the love of my life, but it doesn't look like the relationships of other people. And, you know, it's really interesting of what you said when you first met me, because that's not how I feel inside at all. And, and if anything, I was intimidated. But it's also, I think what I have learned the hard way is that you do not know what's going on in someone else's life. So, for example, you know, all of those days and months and hours that I spent when I was with Rob looking at other people's relationships, and I would definitely say I was envious, not because we weren't in a loving relationship, but I was envious of the normality, because that's what I had signed up for. I had signed up for boring consistency of being with my best mate for however long that was going to be. And everyone else just seemed to have it together. And, you know, everyone else was having kids, or everyone else was doing this and that, or buying a house. And I just kind of looked at where we were at, and I just thought, you know, we're nowhere near that. We're nowhere near whatever picture it is that I have in my head of how I thought our marriage was going to be. And the irony, of course, is now that I look back on it, you know, because of what I speak about, people tell me like a hell of a lot of stuff that they wouldn't tell other people. And now I'm just thinking, you know, I will bet for every single person that they've told about what's going on, so say, let's say someone like me, there's about 20 people in their lives who don't know that that's what's happening. Yeah. Who's looking at, you know, the amazing townhouse that they have, mm-hmm. or, oh, they've just had, you know, their third kid and they've had this amazing first birthday party. And part of me, I hope this isn't cynical, but part of me is like, I'm really happy for them, but I know that what I'm seeing is not the full story.
It never is.
No.
I don't think you're being cynical at all.
We're in the age of comparisons, right? Good things happen to everyone. Bad things happen to everyone. Mm. It's just that, unfortunately, when you're not necessarily in the best place, you look at all the good things that are happening to other people, mm-hmm. and you use that as this comparison point to where you currently are and how you emotionally are.
I do it all the time.
Yeah. And it's just, unfortunately, I mean, is there a cure to it? I don't know. I just think it's human nature.
It's because we know the rules. We know it's a fantasy. It's not like we're going, oh, but I believe it all. We know, but we still, by default, and it is like you say, when you're having a bad day, when you're already feeling vulnerable, weak, that you will probably search those things out. Yeah. And if it wasn't Instagram, we'd be doing it in some other way, more than likely. So you've talked so brilliantly already about dealing with that almighty struggle that was put upon you, and And not only depression, but also you're dealing with addiction as well. And I'll be honest with you, Paula, I have dated a lot of addicts. And it's definitely been a reoccurring lesson for me. And my husband now, and he's very open about this, is sober and clean and very dedicated to that. And, you know, even that takes a lot of consideration and time. But, you know, we're in a very good place and everything. But, you know, from as far back as I can remember with boyfriends, it's been very turbulent in that area. And the one thing, not now at this point in life, but certainly growing up, when that destructive behaviour was in my stratosphere, that in turn would usually lead me down a road of self-destruction. And not with drugs and alcohol, that's never been a problem for me, thankfully. But in many other ways, I've either not looked after myself physically, haven't been eating properly, have been not sleeping well, going out a lot, hanging out with people that I knew weren't necessarily good for me. And it was this sort of weird mirror effect in a relationship where I would go off in my own self-destructive cyclone over here whilst they did theirs there, because I was trying to help, knew I couldn't, and then spinning off in this direction. Did you ever feel that you had tendencies to go off and be destructive in your own way, or was it very important that you kept yourself very together to be as strong as you could for Rob?
So definitely was the latter. So I also have never had a problem with alcohol or drugs. I mean, I wasn't great in my 20s around alcohol, I would say, but let's face it, who is?
No, I love drinking. Don't get me wrong. I just didn't tip into problematic
Exactly.
areas.
It was never, I'm never and have never been the person that's like, oh, it's 11 a.m., you know, I'm going to start drinking then or anything like that. And it's just not in me. So when I was trying to help Rob through his recovery and all of the chaos, as you know, that addiction brings around that, what it made me become was incredibly, I don't want to use the word controlling because that insinuates that I was controlling him, but it's more like I needed to be in control of everything. And when something happened, which then threw that off course, so not necessarily even to do with Rob, like actually more often than not, it was just complete random stuff. The overreaction on my part was just incredible. And I think what happened was I used to go to a support group because I needed a space where I could talk about Rob being an addict and how I felt about that and so on, in a space where it didn't feel like I was being judged. And also just to kind of get advice from people that were going through something similar. And I saw that on all of their faces in terms of, so the fact that they were going to a support group means that they weren't self-medicating themselves, right? But all of them, you know, had very heightened sense of anxiety around things that they really probably shouldn't have had, and definitely needed to control certain situations. So a classic example was I went to Spain with my best friend and my sister. And they will not thank me for saying this, but they were both in the car and I was kind of like watching them try to reverse the car. And basically one of them, who shall remain nameless, drove on some steps. So the car was basically stuck on these steps and we were like, oh my God, we're in Cadiz. What are we going to do? We're going to have to get a tow truck. And they were completely fine about it. I was completely flipping out. And then afterwards, you know, they said, look, like, you know, you just kind of, the way you reacted to that, it actually wasn't that bad. You know, we were going to get it sorted out in the end. And that's a really silly example, but it is an example of how something that actually really didn't deserve the reaction that it ended up getting. But it was because I was so stretched thin across other areas when it came to, you know, Rob's unpredictability and is he going to pick up the phone and has he relapsed and is he going to be okay and how is his recovery going?
I think that's so prevalent for people in many ways, if they've even had a turbulent childhood and then they're still trying to sort of relinquish control later on in life. It can be small moments that tip you over into this abyss and you just feel like it can be a tiny thing like you say, but you just want things to be in line and in control, I guess, to feel safe, secure. There's a lack of that going on.
Safety is a huge thing. I mean, so I talked to Rob about this, about the idea of safety. And I just said, look, you know, in our relationship, I love you so much. And obviously you make me feel safe. But I said, it's up to a point, because when you are actively using drugs or alcohol, I don't really know what's going to happen, because I'm not dealing with, you know, someone else who doesn't have a problem with this kind of stuff. I'm dealing with someone who does have a problem and who crucially doesn't have an off switch when it comes to that kind of stuff. So, what ended up happening was that my home was starting to not feel safe. And by that, I mean, you know, for me, my home, and definitely, you know, present day, I went to great lengths to make it feel like this, is it's safe, it's warm, it's a haven from everything else outside. And I would just remember some days, you know, coming home, like after a really long, you know, very full on day at work. And my job at that time was very full on. And I'd kind of go into the house and I was just like, I don't know what's going to be waiting for me inside, you know. I don't know whether, is Rob going to be here? Like, will he still be asleep? Like, what will be going on with him? And more often than not, it was kind of okay. And we'd make dinner and it would be perfectly normal. But I just feel that in a relationship, you shouldn't have to be asking yourself that question, like, what is going to be waiting for me on the other side of the door? And unfortunately, when you are dating an addict, as you know, that is part of your day-to-day reality.
And becomes normal when it shouldn't. Becomes,
exactly.
You know, you go, well, this is absolutely what I feel like when I walk in the door, and this is what I expect. And I guess through patterns of behaviour and time, you forget that it would be acceptable and wonderful for it to be anything other than that. So you just get into the habit of it. And that's, you know, it's a huge shame and puts a lot of strain on the partner, of course. I mean, something that you talk about a lot in the book, obviously, and so brilliantly, and I'm imagining this was excruciatingly difficult to write about, was Rob's suicide. When that happened, obviously, there's so much shock and trauma around that. Was there any part of you that had expected that to happen?
In truth, not really. Ooh. I mean, when I look at his history, so he had attempted suicide before and had failed. And in the book, and this was one of the hardest things to write, was that just before he left for New Zealand, which is where he took his own life, he had a stay at the Priory. And I remember a few days before he was going to go, this was his second stay in the Priory. And I remember a couple of days before, you know, I had come home and like his voice was like really hoarse. And I remember just like, I actually made fun of it. I was like, why are you talking like a lady? Like, what's happened to your voice? Because I'd had tonsillitis before and I was like, oh, maybe he's coming down with that. And he was like, oh no, I think I'm just coming down with something or whatever. And his mum kind of voiced some concern, you know, around like, had he made an attempt on his life before going into the Priory? And I just was like, Prue, you know, no way. I mean, like, he seems really invested in, you know, his health and his care. And at that point, what had happened was, as a consequence of his constant relapse, I had asked him for a separation because I had just gotten to that point where I needed to have some space from him, and I needed him crucially to do his recovery for him, not because he was worried about losing me or anything like that. So I just needed some time away from him. And then when I looked at the notes, you know, all of the doctor's notes, it had said that he had come into the Priory having made an attempt on his life. And how that felt, I mean, I just felt like someone had punched me in the stomach, because I had come home that day, like, I had made a joke about it, and then we had dinner. Like, we had dinner, like, he had dinner and conversation with me, you know, as if we were a normal couple. And that, I don't think I will ever get over the shock of that. But I think he was in New Zealand for about 3 months, and he had engaged with a detox program there. So it's a lot easier to engage with detox programs there than it is in the UK, because we have all sorts of really weird restrictions around someone engaging in help, which still makes me so angry. But they'd accepted him into this program. And the first day that he had gone to this program, that was, so he sort of, you know, kissed his mum and dad goodbye. You know, they said that he seemed really calm, really happy. And then things just kind of snowballed after that, you know, so it would have been their evening, our morning, because of the time difference. And I just got this really weird set of text messages from him. And then we kind of were having this, you know, quite terse exchange, because I couldn't understand what he was saying to me, but he was basically trying to say that he couldn't really, you know, do this anymore. But the language that he was using, it wasn't clear. Like, it was very vague. And he'd used language like that before. And, you know, so I just said, I just don't understand. And, you know, you're making me really worried. What's going on? And then he just kind of went missing. He said, you know, let me just say goodbye to my mum and dad in peace. And, you know, and I'm sorry. And then just kind of went missing. And then we exchanged phone calls, you know, me and the family and so on. And I was so sure. I just said, you know what? I bet you any money he is going to turn up. He's just going to be really sheepish. Yeah. Like, maybe he's been drinking. But I said, like, honestly, don't. And in my heart of hearts, even though I was concerned that he wasn't in contact with us, I was so sure he was going to turn up. Because also, the alternative, I could not think about the alternative.
How can
my
you?
Brain
How
could
can
not
you?
Go there. No. And then when it had been about 12 hours, you know, and my mum-in-law called me, and I knew what the news was because she was crying on the phone. But, like, it wasn't until she actually said the words that I thought, oh, my God, like, you know, the nightmare is real. This has happened. And I even remember saying to her, you know, are you sure it's not someone else? Mm. And now I feel so guilty for saying that because, I mean, who on earth would wish this on someone else? But I was like, maybe it's not him. Like, maybe if they haven't identified him, it's not him. But of course, it was him.
My gosh, I mean, the levels of shock that you're going through, you can't compare them to anything. That is just the absolute worst. Even with a history like Rob's, you don't want to think that's an option or think that that's going to be a reality. You know, it's just the unimaginable. How do you start to believe that you're going to have a good life and a future after such trauma?
I think that the immediate 6 months is literally like getting up, brushing your teeth, going to work, and so on. And some people don't make it to work in that time. You know, some people take 6 months to a year off. I went back fairly quickly about 3 weeks after because I needed to work and I could not imagine anything worse than just sitting at home, you know, with the curtains closed. But there was a point when I just thought, okay, so what does this mean? I'm grieving for Rob, but what does this mean for my life? Because I could let this completely break my life and shatter it, or I can look at what I need to do to be able to heal and recover from it. And it's not like I coherently had those thoughts, you know, one day. I think this was just a gradual understanding that one life was already lost and I couldn't let my life be lost in it as well, because it's actually quite a common thing that ends up happening. Mm. And the only thing that I could do to just maintain my sanity was to write. And so it was to write and articulate, you know, what I was thinking and how I felt about Rob, because especially a suicide it's such a complex death. There are so many different types of emotions in addition to loss and sadness, you know, factoring in guilt, responsibility, all of those types of things. So I started writing and sifting things from that about what I needed in my life to make myself feel whole again. And I think a really big part of that was that it was to embrace the fact that the person that I was when I was with Rob was no longer here. You know, that person had unfortunately dissipated. But what I could do was to take the best parts of who I was as a person when I was with him and to build on that. And so for me, a big part of that was empathy and compassion and understanding of just how big and how complicated life was. And to be able to, I'm not saying like, you know, sit down and talk to people about their problems, but to be the sounding board or to be the counterpoint that could just give a bigger perspective than what the average person would, and to be able to help other people to heal as well, I found incredibly healing for myself. I mean, I still don't know what I'm going to do about certain aspects of my life, but the writing for me was important because it told people things, something that they didn't know about. Mm-hmm. So for example, you know, we don't necessarily talk hugely about suicide. I mean, we're getting better in terms of talking about mental health and addiction and so on. But I felt that people just didn't know how to handle me because they didn't know what a suicide death does to a person. So I thought, okay, right, I can explain that and thereby make your understanding of it, you know, bigger. But also just, you know, there are so many partners and spouses who are dealing with someone or who are with someone that they love very much who has problems with mental health, for whom there's not a huge amount that articulates that experience. And so I just thought, actually, I'd really also want to be able to be the arm around the shoulder for someone that just might be going through that. And then the sort of final thing to that was around someone who might be struggling with their mental health, just to kind of say, you know, I kind of get it. Like, we get it. There are people amongst us who understand and who aren't expecting you to be fixed, because there is no such thing as a fix when it comes to mental health. But all of those things and doing all of those things, helped, I think, to piece me back together again, but also just gave me this goal of what I wanted to strive towards and who I wanted to be as a person.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How important do you think properly grieving is, you know, versus suppressing or just marching through life? Do you have to surrender to it, or is it important to at some point stop that process and feel somewhat healed, if that's possible, and continue in a new direction?
So I think with grief, I never really had any experience of it. I mean, my grandparents are all deceased, and you know, one of them I'd never met, and the other three sort of died, you know, because of things related to old age. And we miss them dearly, but it just wasn't the same kind of grief at all.
Well, I guess, you know, same here, my grandparents were like, but you know it's going to happen.
Yeah.
There's a underlying awareness that you prepare for that. And but when it is a partner, God forbid, a child, you know, anyone.
A shocking death.
That's world crumbling. Everything shakes to its core, you know, life changed forever.
Yeah, so that kind of grief, I think people are generally quite bad at dealing with grief. So it wasn't something that really I learned from anyone. What I think saved me and just placed me, you know, weirdly in good stead to be able to deal with something like this was, before Rob passed away, a really big line of work that I was in that I felt passionately about was around well-being. So it was around things like, you know, how you fortify your own mind. So whether that's through making sure that you're getting enough sleep, you know, doing the right practices around that. Also was a huge fan of meditation, but just basically that checking in with yourself as a person. So I had already begun practices around that. And, you know, just things like knowing that I needed to take myself off from time to time and go for a run or to be by myself, or just learning how to say no to people, which is an incredibly important, empowering thing if you can master it. So I think, with dealing with that kind of grief, I just knew, and I don't really know how I knew this, but I knew that there wasn't going to be a shortcut to this. I knew that it was intense. At times it was absolutely awful, mainly because you weren't really feeling like one emotion at one point. You know, one minute you would be okay. The next minute you would just be really, really sad. The next minute I'd be so angry, you know, my face would just heat up. And it's just getting accustomed to how quickly those emotions change. I mean, that in itself is hugely exhausting. So I think what I decided to do was I just thought, you know what, I'm going to have to really, really prioritize me. And I don't say that in a selfish way. It's just like being aware of things that I was and was not capable of. So for example, you know, on a day at work, if I could not go into the office, I was not going to be going into the office. Celebrations were a big one. So people's birthdays or, you know, first kids' birthday parties or weddings especially. I think I didn't go to weddings for the first 2 years after Rob passed away. I mean, don't get me wrong. There were things that people said that were helpful. For example, you know, my best mate was like, I was still staying in the flat that Rob and I had lived in. And basically things were kind of, I'd put his stuff in the loft, but things were pretty much how he'd left them. So paintings that he'd put up on the wall. And I was dithering about moving house. And I think my best mate just said very gently, you know, I think you might want to move out. She didn't say you should move out. And it kind of sank in and I thought about it, mulled it over. And I thought, actually, you know what? She's right. I think I'm just holding on to this. And so suggestions like that are helpful. But I think when I really totally went apeshit was when someone suggested that it was time for me to move on. And I just was like, firstly, this hasn't happened to you. Like, no. Your spouse is still alive and kicking, yeah, and sitting next to you on the sofa.
You have no right, yeah, to say something like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah. And it's just like, I understand with my compassion hat on, I understand the impetus for it. I understand they're saying that because they don't want to see me in so much pain. And they think that by dribbling out this, you know, seemingly helpful nugget of information, I'm somehow going to go, oh, yeah, you know what? I didn't think about that. Maybe, yeah, I should move
great
on.
Great idea.
Yeah.
But also, is it because people don't understand that, you know, I'm not saying grieving's a great thing, yay, but it's an important thing. And it's something to be honoured rather than, come on, speed this up, get over it. It's something that you do have to honour.
Yeah, and I think that also being consciously aware of like markers like that, of where you are this year, the next year, the following year, is really important because it helps you to measure your grief. So, for example, I'm approaching, in a couple of weeks, Rob's death anniversary. Now, the first year, I felt it coming about 2 to 3 months before the actual date itself. The second year, it was about a month. We're in the third year. I've probably felt it coming maybe about 3 weeks to 2 weeks. So that time is lessening. But there's nothing I can really do to, you know, hasten the process. It's going to kind of happen at its own point. But I think what people, when they don't understand grief, I think that what they're wondering about is, you know, are you wallowing in your grief? And it's a bit unkind. It's an unkind word to use. And I definitely would say there are dangers of wallowing in your grief. But sometimes, you know what? You just need to wallow. But the difference is give yourself a day. You don't maybe talk to anyone. You be kind to yourself at home. But that next day, it's all about the next day. You have to get up the next day and go out there. Otherwise, that ends up becoming this rolling pattern of wanting to disengage from the world. And trust me, I've been there, and it's a dark and horrible place to be in.
How do you begin to, I guess, trust the unknown? Because I was having this conversation just last week with a relative of mine who lost a brother very, very young. And, you know, she's been through a huge grieving process. And again, she's made that decision that she's going to honour him and his life and, you know, do all the things that she knows he would have wanted her to do. And that's, you know, something that she's learned in a very awful way. But also the repercussions of that shock have been an anxiety that she hasn't quite learned to live with yet, and one that she definitely struggles and manifests in different ways. But having trust that something awful isn't on the horizon constantly, how do you begin to sort of mitigate those feelings that I'm sure are unavoidable?
So for me, therapy was a huge part of how I mitigated some of the, you know, the anxiety or not knowing. And because that anxiety also spills out into anger. So and actually unfair anger. So I found myself very angry at people who were completely naturally, as they should be, moving on with their own lives, because I was not there yet. And I was locked in this grief, and I knew that I would not feel anything resembling normality for a while. So having a sort of a neutral person who you can talk to about this, who can basically restore a sense of perspective that isn't, you know, wrapped up in concern, for me was really important. But I think in terms of the unknown, I've been doing a lot of thinking about this recently. So I'm writing another book, which is a sort of broader look around, you know, finding meaning in your life and also direction, is that there a lot of what you're grieving or that you're anxious about is the lack of the future that you have with this person that you've lost. And so, you know, I was kind of in this space, quite a negative space, where I was just like, you know, but if only this hadn't happened, then my life would have been completely different. And actually, what I am yearning for is the best version of something that never happened, even when he was around. So I am yearning for the perfect, Sunday afternoon with our kids, hanging out, having dinner. And it's like, but we didn't necessarily have that in our real life. So what I am kind of trying to strive towards is something that may never have happened anyway. So for me, once I just realized that, I thought, okay, so what is it that I actually do want from my life? And what are the things that I don't have to have an answer around? So I find it really helpful to write things down. And learning how to let go of the stuff that you don't have an answer around just yet, I find that that is the best way to just release that anxiety and kind of let it go. But also, you know, if I notice that my brain is like churning, so especially with anxiety, you know, you've got this like one thought and it's just like you're chewing on it like a dog with a bone. And if I notice I've been doing that, you know, for more than 5 minutes, I just put a timer on my phone for 10 minutes and I just breathe through it. And then by the end of it, it works for me anyway. I just feel so much lighter around
That's so brilliant, because it is sitting with that feeling rather than, I need to do something to get rid of it. I need to put it on someone else or buy something or eat something. It's actually sitting with that discomfort. Because the thing is, none of us know what's happening in the next 10 seconds even. Like, absolutely none of us do. But we all weirdly slip into this sort of faux, you know, thought process that it's all very linear. And, you know, even like tomorrow, I know that in my diary, I'm doing this, this and this. So that will all happen. And then that's going to happen. And then I hope that in a month, then that's going to, and that's my goal. But you've had that taken away from you to see a sort of a more exposed version of life, I guess. Do you feel more deeply? Does everything feel heightened or brighter or more extreme or heightened since you experienced this?
Well, I'm a Googler. So when I am going through something tough, I love to like Google to find out what other people have gone through or what they think. And I know that a big part of bereavement, and especially a suicide, is you can get very caught up in wanting to, again, control stuff. Or, you know, when you enter into a new relationship, or like, let's say you have kids, you just kind of get very intense around whether or not something's going to happen to that person. And because you're just worried that it's going to happen again. And I have to say, that is not how I am. Maybe because I think I'm just quite aware of it. And I just don't really think that that's a way to live your life. So my personal perspective around a lot of that stuff is, and what I tell myself actually as a mantra is, the worst possible thing happened to me that could have happened to me in my understanding. And you know what? I recovered from it and I managed to rebuild my life. So basically, I can do anything. So if I manage to rebuild my life after something like that, there is no amount of rubble that I can't use to rebuild my life again. So that's what I tell myself.
I love that. But that is wonderful to hear for people that feel broken beyond help. And there's a lot of people out there that do, that just think, well, I'll never recover. You know, and I've not lost anyone by, you know, who's taken their own life, but I've certainly been in a place where I've thought, nope, not recovering from this, no way out, definitely stuck here forever. And I think to hear somebody else say it and know it's possible is a gift in itself, because you see other people around doing it. That's inspiration. You work out small ways of how they did it. And then you start to just small, like you say, it's small changes and it's being kind to yourself. And I think it's a strange British thing that we've got into, that being kind to yourself is sort of either a luxury or a bit naff.
I think we view it as being selfish. I mean, Brits definitely view taking time for yourself or saying that you are not going to do something as being selfish. It's like the classic, it comes from the same well as saying sorry when you want say, excuse me, I kind of need to move past you.
So weird, aren't we?
We're so weird.
I know a big part of this grieving for you and I guess searching or exploring life after Rob's passing is travelling and going to not only New Zealand, where Rob was from, but getting out into the world and exploring cultures, people, families, life, love. Why do you have that burning desire and what has it brought to you?
The biggest thing that I learned from travelling was that, A, there are people who live completely differently and have a different sense of privilege that you might have. And I definitely recognize that within myself, for example, when I went to India. B, I also think that travel just reminds you that the world is not such a fixed place. Mm. So maybe because I'm doing the travel in my late 30s, as opposed to, you know, backpacking around somewhere in my 20s. But what I understood and what I took away from it was that there are lots of different people leading different types of lifestyles because they made a decision around what was right for them. So I think if you live in a city, you know, it's very easy to think that that is the only way to live. And for sure, there's this dissonance because you feel trapped by it to a certain extent. So, you know, you feel like you should want to escape it or you should be escaping it, but you can't because, you know, and then you'll tick off all of these reasons why, to do with work, money, whatever, as to why you need to stay. And I think travel just reminds you that human beings are incredibly adaptable and also they have a lot to teach. Like, I think just meeting people from different backgrounds to you and different cultures and understanding, it's not like someone sitting there lecturing you about what to do, which actually we do quite a lot, I think, in cities, surprisingly, considering we're supposed to be, you know, places of learning and open-mindedness. But I just think looking at how other people lead their lives, I definitely took a lot of lessons from how I could apply that to my own life. So the classic thing when I came back was everyone has asked me, oh my God, is it really traumatic coming back? And I was like, well, no, because I kind of like my life. Mm. But traveling has given me this broader sense of perspective than before I started the journey. So actually, it was completely worth it.
And I guess, you know, these charities like Calm and Mind are a lot more out there now. And they've always been doing this fantastic work. But I guess if you're not feeling like you can talk to someone you know, there are other ways of talking to people that you don't. And that might be maybe a little easier, one step removed from admitting to someone that you love or that you know that there's a problem. Saying just to an impartial person, I think I need a bit of help, is just the most brilliant thing you could do if you are feeling completely at the depths of despair.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like that. I know I'm not a man. I feel that it's incredibly hard for me to ask for help. I'm super proud. And there are probably, I would say, two people in this world when I'm struggling or when I'm feeling at a particular like frequency of being low, that I will be able to force myself to send a message and to say, I really need your help. This is how I'm feeling. But like, that's literally like two people. And even then, it might still take me a full day to send that message. I don't know why that is. I mean, I don't know whether it's pride, because I feel that I should be able to just get over it. And I think that that's a huge part of it. But also, I really don't want people to think of me as being weak. And that is part of the whole problem, right? Mm. And so when you then amplify that to men and the ideas and the preconceptions they have around feeling weak, I'm just like, oh my God, like, we have to do something to be able to give permission around anyone, like man, woman, child, to be able to say things are really not okay with me and I'm really not fine. And for them to be able to do that and not self-stigma against themselves that they're just bad or they're weak because
they should cope. That they should be able to cope.
Yeah.
Why should you be? Life is tough. Life can be really hard.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, how, I don't know how we do it, but getting people to see that being vulnerable openly, that is the strength. That is the bit that's really strong. You know, I went to this incredible session with the charity Mind, and it was terrifying. It was a group session, and I sat in, as everyone else did in the room, complete strangers, maybe 15 of us. And we did a workshop where we had to sort of write down thoughts and feelings. It was a poetry, spoken word thing. And then stand up and read. And I was thinking, nope, not doing this. Thank you. Not for me. But by the end of it, because I could see all these other people and, you know, men and women, probably an equal divide from all different parts of London, all different backgrounds. by about half an hour in, I felt so connected to these people and I didn't want to say a word. By the end, of course, I'm stood up like reading my frigging silly poem I've written, but it's that moment where you realize that that weakness is the strength. That is the bit that is like holding you together with other people. And when you recognize it in them, you can then see it in yourself and you go, oh my God, this is okay. This is absolutely fine. And again, it is part of that kind of Britishness to be very, you know, strong about things and tough. And it's hopefully and possibly very slowly things are changing and the perception of that is changing. And that can only be a good thing.
For sure. I mean, I think that there are two things when we're talking about someone opening up about problems. So number one, for that person to understand and go into it with hope that they are talking about something that they feel vulnerable about and have kept hidden inside. And more often than not, if I was the other person on that on the side of that conversation, I can't imagine a scenario in which a mate would talk to me about stuff and I would treat it with anything less than, I'm going to give you a hug and don't worry and keep talking. However, there are people that aren't necessarily like that and who are so shocked by what they are being told, or maybe they just don't know what to say, that people just kind of instantly go for a default, oh, you know, don't worry, you'll get through it, without offering any advice or help as to how that person's going to get through it. So I think number one, you know, people should feel a bit more confident about opening up about what's going on. But number two, I think that if you are the other person on the end of that, just understand that you're probably not being told stuff because they want your advice. You're probably being told stuff because they just need someone to listen.
Paula, I cannot thank you enough for A, traipsing over to my house today, but B, for being so beautifully open about this experience, because I'm not sat here imagining that this is great fun for you to talk about the most traumatic thing in your life, but you're present and you're willing to do it and you're open, and that is invaluable to so many people. So thank you.
Thank you for having me, honey.
Paula Bell. What a woman, and she's become a great friend too. You can read all about her experiences in her beautiful book, Chase the Rainbow. I absolutely loved it, and I know you will too. If you've been affected by anything in this podcast, please, please talk about it with someone. If that's tricky for you at the moment, you can always talk in confidence to the Samaritans at any time on 116 123. That's 116 123 in the UK. And we've details for other locations in our show notes. Next week, we'll meet YouTube superstar Zoe Sugg.
People are a bit immune to empathy, I think, at this point. And not a lot of people remember that there's a person reading that at the other end.
You can get that episode to appear magically on your phone first thing Monday morning when you subscribe. Just search on your podcast app of choice. And please, if you use Apple Podcasts, do leave us a review because that helps others find the show. Thanks to Paula and to the producer Matt Hill and Lucy Dearlove at Rethink Audio. I'll see you next week.